Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelation in the Washington Post that in early January, the notorious mercenary Eric Prince, the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, took part in a clandestine meeting in the Seychelles Islands with a confidant of Putin's in an effort to establish a back channel between the Trump White House and the Kremlin. The author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and a biographer of Eric Prince, Robert Young Pelton, joins us from Kabul, Afghanistan, to discuss the reckless amateurism and freelancing that characterizes the chaotic vacuum inside Trump's all-but-absent foreign policy, with the blind leading the clueless, as all sorts of opportunists and ideologues come out of the woodwork to make America great again, to make money, or in Eric Prince's case, make war. Then we look into the brazen depravity of the Assad regime in Syria, which just used what appears to be sarin gas against Syrian civilians, then later targeted hospitals and clinics treating the over 100 survivors and medics attending the wounded. An expert on Syria, James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA and author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us to explain Assad's mindset and his belief that in spite of condemnations from the West, he will get away with killing his own people and destroying his country. Then finally, we will examine the breakdown of democracy in Hungary and Poland as populist leaders in both countries attack constitutional courts and other checks and balances while turning public media into a propaganda arm of the government. Peter Krecko, a visiting Fulbright scholar at the Center for Global and International Studies at Indiana University and the director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, Hungary, joins us to discuss the reversal underway in what were models of democratic change after the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. And joining us now from Kabul, Afghanistan, is Robert Young Pelton, author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine, has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, and License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hi, Ian.
So, Robert, you were hired by Eric Prince, the notorious mercenary brother of the Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. He's come up again in a story that the Washington Post broke that the United Arab Emirates arranged a secret meeting in January between Eric Prince and a Russian close to President Vladimir Putin with the aim at creating a back channel, a secret back channel between Trump and Putin. So you were hired by Prince to do his biography. You know the guy. What do you make of this story?
Well, it's interesting because it doesn't seem to have any sources other than some mysterious intelligence sources inside the U.S., and it sounds a little bit like the story with Flynn, and there seems to be a manifest that says that a member of the UAE royal family was in the Seychelles, and obviously that Eric Prince was there. They do a lot of business together. But there's no clear evidence that there's any corroborating sources. So this sounds like part of a continuing campaign to wind in the idea of Russia and people who want to reform the intelligence business. And one of the things that Flynn wanted to do, and I worked with Flynn in Afghanistan, was to reform the sort of very high-dollar, good old boy network that pervades the CIA. And Eric has also been a critic of, government waste and sloth, et cetera, et cetera. But what's interesting is that this seems to have electrified the media because it's linked to Russia and it's linked to Trump. So I don't know if it's actually true or not. I don't know if they were talking about Russia, but it clearly seems that the crosshairs are on Prince.
Well, but when you say he wants to get rid of government waste and fraud, he's a beneficiary of government waste and fraud, isn't he? I mean, his big contract under Blackwater was with the State Department, and they shot up a bunch of innocent Iraqis, and they lost the contract. Right. So,
yeah, well, this is the irony. This is a staunch libertarian who gets all of his income from the U.S. government. So, I mean, it's almost humorous. These days, of course, he wants to get back in with the Trump administration, mostly through Pence, Vice President Pence, and he wants to be a reformer. But I don't quite know how the Trump administration is going to deal with him, because he seems to guarantee that any secret deal becomes very public.
Well, the article in the Washington Post cites government sources, and the assumption here is that the FBI is, just quoting from the Washington Post, U.S. officials said the FBI has been scrutinizing the Seychelles meeting as a part of a broader probe of Russian interference in the 2016 elections and alleged contacts between associates of Putin and Trump. And the FBI declined to comment on the matter. But what is clear is that Flynn, the ousted national security advisor, General Flynn, and the son-in-law, Kushner, were joined by Stephen Bannon in a meeting with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Zayed. That was in December, before the meeting that took place in the Seychelles, which was on January the 11th, shortly before Trump's inauguration. So that's pretty established. And what's interesting about that meeting with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, with Bannon, Kushner, and Flynn, is that the guy snuck into the country, the UAE sheikh, and they only found out the Obama administration was not informed, according to protocol, about the visit, but they found out about it. So that's in itself raises some questions, doesn't it?
Yeah, so what's been happening is that when Trump was getting ready to be president, there were a number of forays by his friends and supporters to set up some kind of linkages to not just Russia, but multiple foreign countries, including the UAE. Now, I haven't seen any grand strategy from President Trump on what he intends to do with these backdoor channels or Russia or whatever. But you have to remember that this gets very complicated when you include the statement that they were trying to drive a wedge between Iran and Russia. And I don't see Eric Prince ever succeeding in that.
Well, that's the wish list of the Saudis and the Emiratis, isn't it? I mean, they're obsessed with Iran.
Eric Prince is supporting them in that war. So the funny thing is that Eric is making a lot of money supporting the war against the Iranian proxies and the Shia folks in Yemen and around that region. So he has a vested interest in promoting the war. And you remember Eric was also nailed for presenting an idea to Haftar via Europe to run these air tractors with, you know, spy equipment and smart bombs.
Haftar being the rebel leader in Libya.
Right, and he is sort of kind of backed by the U.S., but he's definitely backed by the UAE. So this is a diplomacy gone loony, because we're also supporting the other side in Libya, and here's Eric supporting Haftar's side. So you have the same problem where we're trying to get out of Yemen, and he's trying to convince us to get into Yemen.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's in Kabul, Afghanistan. He's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer, and the publisher of Dangerous Magazine. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, and License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, a book that profiles Eric Prince. And Robert was hired by Eric Prince to do his biography, but then Prince decided he didn't want to pay you, right? He likes to get billions from the government, but he doesn't like to pay his bills, right? Is that?
I got him a $1 million deal with Penguin, and then he decided to get $2 million. So, you know, more power to him. But at the end of the day, you're seeing chaos in the way that Trump handles diplomacy. You're seeing a lot of people knocking on the White House door trying to get favor or influence by saying, look, I know this guy and I can set up a meeting with that guy, which is very businesslike, but it's not very government-like.
Well, what's happening now with Trump trying to distract and cover his tracks over that outrageous tweet attacking Obama and calling him a bad or sick guy, the stuff that they've tried to pull in the White House through the National Security Council, through one of Flynn's proteges, who one of the so-called Flynnstones, this 30-year-old guy who General McMaster wanted to fire, along with all these other people that Flynn brought in, and this guy ran to Kushner and Bannon to keep his job, and he's behind providing this phony documentation that Trump is trying to, and the echo chamber at Fox News are trying to suggest that somehow the Obama people we're doing something terrible when it's nothing more than what's called incidental collection that comes up every day and is no big deal. It's certainly not the same as accusing the previous president of wiretapping you at Trump Tower and calling him a sick, bad guy. So much of what's the, you talk about the chaos, it's all about this man himself and his mental state and his inability.
Let me give you an example. I'm here in Afghanistan meeting with senior members of the Afghan government, and they're baffled. They don't know what the U.S. policy towards Afghanistan is. You have a fairly large investment in this country. You know, we're spending billions of dollars, and the four-star is having a hard time convincing people that we're still spending the money. We just don't have the tools to figure out what it's doing. So I think this method of confusion, I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's just there's just confusion, is causing our allies to really stop and think about, you know, how reliable the U.S. is.
Well, obviously they're going to probably send Jared over, right? They sent him to Iraq with a four-star, and sitting there, in a meeting, and he's this 36-year-old with just about every portfolio that exists within this new administration. Not humanly possible to have all those jobs. But isn't there, I was just making the point that the confusion comes from Trump himself and from his personality and from the fact that he believes crazy stuff that from Breitbart and from Alex Jones and tweets it out. And now we learn from the recent first Senate intelligence hearing that from Clint Watts that the Russians are basically feeding Trump fake news, which he then parrots back. So this is a crazy world.
Well, but you know, once again, we've invested a lot of energy and time in what we call the war on terror, and we have troops all around the world, you know, across Africa, South Asia, and they're not crazy people. You know, they have very serious agendas that need funding, and there's a lot of programs that they need to continue. So it's very disheartening when you travel around the world and people ask you, what's Trump going to do, or what's wrong with America, or how did you elect this person? And honestly, I don't have an answer for them.
Well, the last conversation we had, though, was where we talked about the possibility that what Eric Prince is up to with his relationship with Bannon, and you mentioned that Eric Prince is closer to Mike Pence. I think he's also pretty close to Bannon, isn't he? But the idea that they might be ginning up a war or an incident with Iran, and of course, Prince being located there in the Gulf with a mercenary army is in a position to execute such a mission. So let me start. We'll get to that in a minute. But let's tell us about what you know about the relationship between Mike Pence and Eric Prince.
Well, it's not just Eric Prince. I mean, Eric Prince comes from a family that has, you know, his father, after his first heart attack, became very focused on family values and religion and, you know, what you could call a conservative right, and set up a number, or at least bankrolled a number of institutions that Mike Pence's lifestyle and beliefs reflect. So his sister, you know, Betsy, was one of the largest, if not the largest, contributors, you know, to the Republican fundraising effort. And his mother, who runs the foundation, continues her support of, you know, what they call family values, which is anti-abortion, anti-gay, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, Eric is not necessarily, you know, synchronized with that. And he's gone off and created his own sort of little mercenary empire by acting as a proxy for some of our dirty wars. And he was famous for saying that, you know, the CIA and the State Department couldn't operate without him in Iraq because he provided so much of the infrastructure to allow them to operate, including hiring senior members like Kofor Black and Rob Riker from the CIA to work directly for him. So he left in a huff after Secretary of State Clinton tried to burn down his business and was successful in doing that. And then he basically started working with covert elements of the U.S. to build up these proxy armies, which you see in the UAE that are now fighting in Yemen and in places where we don't even know we're fighting war. So he has an agenda, this very bizarre agenda of being a libertarian, someone who thinks he's fighting for American values, but is working directly with some of the rootstocks of the Wahhabism and the support that has created a lot of these jihadi groups. So it's a bizarre combination. There's no clear window to what he's doing. So Mike Pence is, if you believe the conspiracy theorists, is the chosen one. In other words, Trump is going to get so rope-a-doped by the media and scandals, et cetera, that they're almost hoping that he'll either get impeached or resign, and then Mike Pence will become president, and then you will have your fundamentalist president.
Praise the Lord. Well, and there you are.
But this lunacy is injected into this entire administration, where everybody has a theory. Everybody says this is what's going to happen. This guy knows this guy. But there's no clarity. There's just confusion.
Right. Well, but isn't this a combination of arrogance and amateurism?
I think in business you can get away with this attitude because your business runs itself, but the government needs direction. I mean, our allies need clear understanding of what we're doing with them. You know, the population of America wants to know how their health insurance is going to work. And, you know, these are things that governments are supposed to do. By being contrarian, and being contrarian on every single level, including hiring people deliberately to tear down the institutions they're in charge of, I think the American people are very, very concerned that we actually did hire an incompetent person to run the country.
So just in terms of personality, though, and motivation, when you mentioned a minute ago, Robert Young Pelton, that Eric Prince got shut down by Hillary Clinton, I understand he has a burning hatred of her, just like Putin apparently has a burning hatred of her. So could that be a motivating factor in Eric Prince meeting with this top Russian official who's supposed to be close to Putin in the Seychelles along with the UAE sheikh? Apparently this meeting was all about creating a back channel between Trump and Putin.
Right. So you have to remember that Eric Prince fancies himself as a spy and tried to joined the CIA in 2001 and failed the polygraph because he lied about an affair he had. And then he came back as a national asset, setting up fake companies for the CIA to pour money and people into. And that was all shut down and in a very publicized event. And then he left in 2010. What he wants to be is one of those sort of eminent greed, one of these people that sits behind the scenes and pulls the strings. So he can make money, but not necessarily be, you know, the focus of public attention. And this goes back to the old robber barons and the old American ideas of people, you know, he's a libertarian. He wants to control politics without actually being a politician or serving in the government.
Well, that's, you know, he's got that in common with Mercer, the billionaire that's also involved in financing Trump and Bannon and I believe he's also close to Prince and, of course, the Koch brothers. So this is definitely, there are the rubber barons in waiting, hovering around this administration. But you
also have groups. You also have groups within the Central Intelligence Agency on the seventh floor that are looking to create confusion. I mean, part of this Russia obsession is not necessarily linked to any threat that Russia is providing to us. But it is a constant refrain to create doubt in the sort of, you know, loyalty or goals or ideas of the Trump administration. And I think it's wiser to look at the facts and say, these are people that don't know what they're doing, you know, grasping for straws and doing silly things that end up with nothing happening or just embarrassment. So we have to be very cautious not to be caught into this sort of bipolar left-right argument that the media is enjoying.
Right, but that is not as if the Trump people and Trump himself haven't given a lot of ammunition. I mean, you've got to start with the premise that something actually did happen with the Russians, you know, and I think that's pretty well established. Now we're just learning from my friend Ali Watkins at BuzzFeed News that the Russian FSB spies recruited Carter Page. It was, after all, Carter Page. When Trump first did his first foreign policy discussion with the editorial board of the Washington Post way back earlier in the campaign, he was asked about who are your foreign policy advisors, and he mentioned Walid Faris, is a pretty controversial phalangist from Lebanon. And then the second person Trump mentioned was Carter Page, PhD. And this is the same guy that the FSB are trying to recruit. I mean, give us a break. There's some smoke there, surely.
Yeah, but once again, the goal of this meeting was to drive a wedge as you know, President Obama tried to build a bridge with Iran. In other words, de-escalating some of the tension and the sanctions so that we would have less conflict. Trump and Prince are both trying to escalate tension between Iran and the rest of the world. And if we're making overtures towards Russia to help us in places like Libya, we're trying to also escalate conflict against Iran by supporting Saudi Arabia and the UAE and what they're doing. So this is where you need to focus, is they're trying to reset the global battlefield so that we start another war in Iran, which then generates income, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the dangerous part.
Right, but in a war with Iran would help Putin, would it not? The price of oil would go through the ceiling, and that would rescue his economy.
Yes, and then you get that, once again, is, you know, Putin flows into the areas that we're not. So when we aren't aggressive in a certain area, the Russians will come in and make money by supporting them as allies. So I don't think Putin cares either way. You know, they are a neighbor to Russia. They're not a, you know, we don't really care about Iran. We're fixated on the 70s and a lot of the things that happened a very long time ago. But, you know, Iran is not Iraq or Afghanistan. It's a very different, very large, powerful country.
Right. But just in closing, though, obviously going to war with Iran is crazy. You know, look what Iran did for Jimmy Carter and almost brought down Ronald Reagan. I mean, that's a hornet's nest.
Right.
But there's a very long piece in the Huffington Post today about how U.S. military, senior military officers, particularly Air Force, are very concerned about these increasing incidents with Russian interceptors intercepting U.S. surveillance aircraft in the Baltic, etc. And this is where I think it's dangerous. If you think these guys are trying to, I don't know what their motives would be to try and escalate tensions with Russia, but it is happening, and you've got two basically macho, unstable, impulsive guys. You got Trump here in the United States and Putin over there. That's a pretty lethal mixture, isn't it?
But don't forget that Russia is a small country that's rapidly running out of resources. So we tend to look at Russia as if it's Soviet Russia in the 50s. It's not. Its economy is smaller than Germany. So in terms of its actual ability to deal damage, it's not that much of a threat. What is a threat is global destabilization.
Right, and the fact that they've got a massive nuclear arsenal, and their Russian and American warplanes and warships are playing chicken. That, as we speak, that's not a good thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Europe's in the middle. So I'm just saying it's not just about Russia versus America. It's about Europe sweating that it might have to live with the lights out and be in the middle of a war that it didn't start. So this is what's threatening countries around the world, is the fact that we don't have a clear relationship with Russia or Iran or some of these other partners that we've built up, at least a sense of knowing where we are. So this is the penalty of chaos.
Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi rebel and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, and License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. And he joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking to the brazen depravity of the Assad regime that just used chemical weapons on its own people. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, and the areas of present-day Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And it's pretty extraordinary in that you can still be shocked by the hideous nature of this civil war in Syria and the killed at over 500,000 people, displaced a third of the population, and destroyed a very functioning country. But it looks like the Assad regime have killed at least 58 people with what seems to be sarin gas fired by aircraft firing rockets. And this was in a small town 50 kilometers south of Idlib. And it just seems like, you know, whenever, for example, the other day, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, when he met with Erdogan, as he was leaving, he mentioned that maybe we're not going to insist on Assad being a deal breaker in terms of a peace agreement, that maybe we can live with Assad. And it looks like the minute Assad gets an opening, he ups the ante and he's completely in your face in this hideous way. So what do you make of this man's activities? I find it incomprehensible. Not only would you poison your own people with chemical weapons, then you'd come back and fire rockets at the clinics and hospitals treating them.
Right. Well, it is appalling, of course. If we go back to the beginning of last summer, that's when the regime was on the ropes. And Assad at that point asked the Russians to help him move away from just the defensive line that he and his troops were actually holding. So the Russians did and turned the tide of battle. Ever since then, there really is nothing to prevent Assad from doing what he chooses to do. And it looks like what he's trying to do at the present time is to, as quickly as possible, wipe out as much of the opposition and opposition-held Syria as possible as well. So, I mean, this is just one more step. I mean, if you remember the red line that was there a couple of years ago, we didn't do anything at that time. Our credibility in the region is even less now for doing anything, particularly after the election of Donald Trump. And so, therefore, he figures that this is a time that he can perfectly well wrap things up as much as he can. Very likely there will not be a negotiated end to this. Very likely what will happen is that the Syrian military is going to continue as much as they can with the help of the Russians when it's necessary, and also with the help of the various militias. As a matter of fact, it's mostly the various militias now and not the Syrian military that is moving forward at the present time. If there would be negotiations, I'm sure that Assad's only position at the present time would be to negotiate the surrender of the opposition forces. I mean, this is sort of talk about moving from Astana still to Geneva to reopen the talks again, and very likely that would be the position of the government. The position of the opposition doesn't matter much anymore.
Well, you referred, James Galvin, of course, to the August 2013 chemical attack in Damascus, where after which, well, actually before which, President Obama had drawn a red line. And once that line was crossed, as you know, the British didn't want to get involved. Their parliament voted against military intervention, and Obama decided to take it to the House, to the country, and recognized that America didn't want to get involved in a war in the eyes of many, particularly on the right, he wimped out. Well, guess what? Today, at the White House, Sean Spicer, President Trump's spokesman, blamed what happened on, guess who? Obama. I mean, blame it on the black guy. He said, I'll quote Spicer today, President Obama said in 2012 that he would establish a red line against the use of chemical weapons, and then he did nothing. The United States stands with our allies across the globe to condemn this intolerable act. Well, that's just rhetoric. And frankly, I find it extraordinary that the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, has blatantly ignored questions about this attack from reporters. How could we have a Secretary of State who will not even talk to the American people, let alone the world?
Well, it's because the American policy in the entirety of the Middle East is just indefensible at the present time. We can get back at some point to the idea that the way the previous crisis was solved over the red line was by making sure there were no more weapons, poison gas, in the hands of the government. I mean, that's something else that, frankly, I don't know where the screw-up is on that one. But it just seems that, well, let me put it another way. I've been trying to figure out exactly how Trump is making his Middle East policy, because it seems all over the place and contradictory. And there's only one rationale that I can come up with, which is that part of his foreign policy in the Middle East is anti-Obama and part is anti-Hillary. So you start off with the anti-Obama stuff, for example, the idea that, you know, maybe we should set up these safe zones in Syria, or the anti-Iran, the Iran deal, or, for example, cozying up to Saudi Arabia and Israel again, after the United States had basically said what Trump usually says, which is, you guys are free riders, and it's over now for free riding. The anti-Hillary stuff is the anti-intervention stuff. Hillary, of course, is a liberal internationalist who wants to spread American values throughout the world by the point of a gun, if necessary, so long as there's international law and international organizations that will back it. And so, therefore, you know, when he says, when Trump says, I'm not going to intervene in this battle or that battle or that battle, he's actually going to the anti-Hillary side. I think that this is really the only way in which we can understand overall what Trump's policies actually are in the region. Does it sound like a petty way of setting a policy? Sure. Is Trump just petty enough to do something like that? Sure.
Well, but his people, as I mentioned, Tillerson recently in Turkey suggested that maybe they were going to drop the insistence that Assad had to go. And Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador, who today condemned Syria, saying that Assad was a war criminal who's done disgusting things to his own people, but yet just on Thursday she told a group of reporters that our priority is no longer to sit there and focus on getting Assad out. So short of bluster and condemnation, I guess Assad knows this too, right? The U.S. is not going to do a damn thing and he's going to get away with it, although the French and the British are calling for a U.N. Security Council meeting tomorrow.
And what will the U.N. Security Council meeting provide, you know, particularly since the Russians, of course, are on the U.N. Security Council? So it really is as hopeless as you painted it in the very beginning, which is the fact that Assad thinks that he can get away with literally murder, and he can get away with murder.
So what do you know about this man's pathology then? Here he is, this ophthalmologist with his glamorous wife, and he was in London, and he sort of, his older brother, the heir to the family plantation, which is the country of Syria, he's a playboy, he's driving a Ferrari too fast, gets killed, and they bring Bashar back from London, and he's installed as the dictator in the family business, which is to own Syria. And they run a kind of mafia operation based upon the adherence and allegiance of the minorities in Syria. Is there any way that you can let our audience know, James, what kind of allows a man to murder his own people, his own citizens, with sort of righteous impunity?
Well, when he took office, Bashar al-Assad was considered to be a reformer. A lot of people, my colleagues, for example, many of them, were duped by this as well. There was a brief Damascus Spring, for example, in 2000, which you had this efflorescence of salons and petitions and that sort of thing, which was later crushed. Bashar was not blamed at the time for this. It was his father's cronies who were blamed for this. And at the beginning also of the rebellion, there was this idea that, you know, Bashar is somebody who is not all that bad, but the people who we really have to focus on who are really awful are the people who his father had left behind. I think that is, the horse has left the barn on that one. Bashar, of course, is completely complicit in the system that, you know, that has been set up, that he is not an innocent in this, that he is not somebody who's contending against his father's cronies, that he is somebody who is committing war crimes and is perfectly capable of continuing to commit war crimes. Now, that being said, the what you had also said is also true, which is the idea that the regime, if the regime falls, these people are not going to survive, period. Even if it's not going to be the International Criminal Court, it'll be the Syrian people who will do something about the members of this regime. The minorities around the Assad regime also understand that there might be payback for their complicity in the regime from the Sunni majority within Syria, and so fear that as well and have circled their wagons around the regime. So the Assad position at this point is domestically fairly solid, along with, of course, his military position being very, very solid as well. Can he do such things as use chemical weapons with impunity? Yes, he can, and he has, and will probably continue to do so in the future.
So how do you see this thing? Is there a level of exhaustion, just in closing, though? Is there a level of exhaustion? That's how the Lebanese civil war, and it was pretty brutal, not as bad as this, but still pretty brutal. They just got exhausted, didn't they?
Well, yes, that could happen in Lebanon, but the difference between Lebanon and the Syria situation is the level to which this has become a proxy war in Syria. In other words, Iran doesn't really, it's not just for Iran whether Assad stays. It's Iran's position within the entire Middle East. It's just not, for Saudi Arabia, whether Assad goes. It's Saudi Arabia's entire position within the Middle East. And so each side has, in the past, ramped up its efforts when it was losing. Now, it's fairly apparent now that there is no way that the opposition is going to win militarily. But that doesn't mean that the opposition cannot, for example, still maintain itself, be a thorn in the side of Assad, try to weaken the regime as much as they possibly could with the help of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf powers as well. So this thing looks like it's going to end up, and this has become a cliche in the diplomatic community, it's going to become like Somalia. Syria will be Somalized, as they say, which means, of course, that there will be a government under Bashar al-Assad. They'll print postage stamps and currency. They will hold a seat at the United Nations, all sorts of things like that. But that government will not have complete control over the territory over which it's supposed to rule. The same thing as the Somali case. And so therefore, what we're going to see is Syria ending up as just one more failed state, at least in the foreseeable future.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the breakdown of democracy in Hungary and Poland. الأسود الأسود يا ويلي الثوب الأسود يا ويلي. Hey, rejuvenation. Second wind,
begin. Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Peter Krecko, who is a visiting Fulbright Scholar at the Center for Global and International Studies at Indiana University and the director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, Hungary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Krecko.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity.
And Freedom House, the U.S. pro-democracy group, just issued a report. They follow democratic progress in the former Warsaw Bloc countries of Eastern Europe and the Balkans as well, Central Asia. And their annual study, Nations in Transit, evaluates the state of democracies in these 29 former communist countries. And they're now saying that there's been a spectacular breakdown of democracy taking place in Poland and Hungary. Does that gel with your understanding of what's happening in your country?
I think it's a fair assessment on what's going on in both countries. What we can see in Hungary is that a populist right government elected in 2010, led by Viktor Orban, is systemically demolishing checks and balances in Hungary, and their latest step is that they try to chase out a foreign university, an American Hungarian university called Central European University from Hungary, and also to crack down on civil society organizations following the playbook of Vladimir Putin, practically word by word. But it's a process that is going on for 7 years right now. In Poland, the populist right government was elected in 2015, so we can see that they are rather in the beginning of that process, but they are acting pretty quickly and in very similar direction than the Hungarian government. In fact, the Polish government, which is not that friendly to the Russian government at all, as the Hungarian government, but they receive a lot of inspiration from Viktor Orban, who is a personal friend of the leader of the current governmental party, Jaroslaw Kaczynski.
And Kaczynski's ruling Law and Justice Party, there were demonstrations in front of the presidential palace in Warsaw, Poland on Sunday, on the 20th anniversary of Poland's constitution, post-communist constitution. And a lot of Poles fear that this new constitutional order is being threatened by this populist government of Kaczynski's. And he has already eroded the independence of the Constitutional Tribunal. And he's turned public media into a propaganda outlet for his party. So Hungary, of course, is this reversal of towards autocracy has took place starting in 2010. So they've got the jump on Poland, I guess, in terms of Kaczynski only came into power in 2015. But Orban himself, the Hungarian leader, said that he's declared that he's building an illiberal democracy in Hungary, modeled on Russia, China, and Turkey. So this should not come as a surprise then, should it, if he's already stated? I don't understand his ideology, but perhaps you can explain it to us.
Yeah, it's a fair point. One good thing about illiberal leaders is that usually they are pretty open about their goals. There are not so many political leaders all around the world who used the term illiberal in a positive sense to label themselves. This is what Viktor Orban did back to 2014 after his re-election. And he, in fact, talked not just about illiberal democracy, but an illiberal state. And he even said back then, and he repeated similar messages a lot of times since then, that in order to be successful, you don't necessarily need to be democratic, and especially you don't need to be liberal. Illiberal leaders build up an arch enemy the liberalism, and they use the caricature of liberalism to underline their agenda. And this is that liberalism is an essential threat to the Western and European order, because it undermines the traditional values, it undermines the nation, it undermines the family, it undermines Christianity, and they fight with this caricature of liberalism, which has not too much to do with the reality, but it's good for a counterpoint. And what these leaders, for example, Kaczynski or Orban, but we can, in that respect, they are similar, I think, to Vladimir Putin, for example, or Erdogan, used to argue is that the democracy is just important in the sense that it as the will of the majority. So if they are elected to the positions, as Orban usually says, that no other force can tell them what to do, because they enjoy the support of the majority. And institutions such as constitutional court should not say what the government should or should not do, because it's an obstacle in the way of the will of the majority. So this is what some scholars says, that the dictatorship of the majority, that an anti-minority argumentation referring constantly to the will of people, but of course they are just doing it when they are implementing popular measures. In a lot of cases, they are implementing unpopular measures, and then they are rather afraid about the expression of the opinion of the majority. Let me give an example. Viktor Orban made a big deal with Vladimir Putin over extending the nuclear capacities in Hungary and building a nuclear power plant by Russian loans, which is a highly intransparent project, and it's a highly unpopular project as well. And there were a lot of attempts to bring this case to a referendum where it could be defeated, but the Orban regime have blocked all these attempts because they know that that the majority would rather vote against this power plant. So I think that there is there is an essential contradiction and there is a hypocrisy behind referring to the will of the people, while on the other hand, in unpopular measures, they are just going directly against it.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Krecker, who is a visiting Fulbright Scholar at the Center for Global and International Studies at Indiana University and the director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, Hungary. So the Hungarian Parliament just approved a bill targeting the Central European University, which has been funded by George Soros. And he is somebody that Orban particularly dislikes. But Orban, of course, has embraced President Trump as much as he's embraced Vladimir Putin. And Orban's a big fan of President Trump's, and he also denounces Soros. But Soros is also denounced here in this country by people surrounding Donald Trump, if not Trump himself, and certainly by the right-wing media. And they always refer to him as this kind of demon, just in the way that liberals talk about the Koch brothers as being the finances of all that they find evil in the world. Conservatives blame Soros for just about everything. And Soros, of course, hasn't given that much money to liberal causes, but he certainly has in Eastern Europe. He's a Holocaust survivor who survived both the Nazis and the communists in Hungary. So that kind of muddies the water, doesn't it, a little bit? I mean, we're not exactly out of the woods here in the United States with the Donald Trump presidency that has many of the characteristics, if not the impulses, of Viktor Orban and Kaczynski in Poland.
That's a very important point. One of the speakers of Fidesz, the governmental party in Hungary, referred or tried to explain why they want to launch another crackdown on the civil society in Hungary, they he justified it with that there was an election recently in the United States, and they feel that this is the time. So there is an open reference to that. They feel that there is a new word coming on right now, an illiberal word with big changes even in the United States, and that's why they saw that this is the time to go against Soros-funded NGOs, think tanks, and even universities. The problem with this argument is that I think they miscalculated a bit the real decision-making process in the United States, in the sense that, for example, Central European University seems to be an institution that rather enjoys bipartisan support among the ones who know this institution in the United States. George Pataki was the one who undersigned, for example, then the governor of New York, who undersigned the agreement with the Hungarian government back to 2004. And there were Democrat and Republican politicians who were talking out against this measure of the Hungarian government as well. The Hungarian, the U.S. Embassy in Hungary raised criticism. Also, the State Department raised criticism at this point. So I'm not sure that these measures totally enjoy political support here in the United States. And I think what Orbán rather miscalculates at this point is that it's the American system is not like that. If the president thinks something, then all the decisions will be totally determined by that. This is how the Hungarian system works right now, but this is not how politics works in the U.S. And also, I think he overestimated the importance of that letter that was written by some Republican congressman, including Ted Cruz, for example, to the State Department, asking for that Soros-funded organizations should not be supported by the State Department as well. So you're right, there is definitely a general anti-Soros sentiment in on the right in many countries all over the Western world, including the United States. But I think disagreeing with liberal principles of a businessman and closing down a university might be two different things and under different considerations. And what is the interesting situation right now is that while the Hungarian government had high hopes that there will be very good bilateral relationship between Hungary and the United States, because, as you also said, Viktor Orban endorsed Donald Trump. The first diplomatic move that the Hungarian government did right now is that they ordered the charge d'affaires, the deputy of the ambassador to the Hungarian foreign ministry, because they criticized this Hungarian move. So this is definitely not a good step towards establishing good bilateral ties. So that's why I think the Hungarian government miscalculates the power and this miscalculates the importance of some bilateral issues in the United States.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Peter Krecker, let's get into the sort of the political DNA of both Hungary and Poland when it comes to sympathy for fascists and fascism and authoritarian leaders and anti-Semitism and anti-Roma attitudes. Certainly that has been clear with Orbán, and he's got Jobbik even further to the right of him, a very virulent neo-fascist party. Poland's experience was a little different in World War II, although they did collaborate with the Nazis. They certainly helped round up the Jews, although obviously there were examples of people saving the Jews as well. In Hungary, it was a fascist puppet state, was it not? But they did protect the Jews up and towards the end of the war, and then they were the last to be sent to the camps, as far as I remember. So walk us through how much fascism is in the political DNA of these countries?
I would not necessarily use the term fascism, because it's misleading a bit in the sense that brings us associations that are, that it's something that is deeply rooted in the, let's say, in the race theory of the Nazi regime, and also that this is a totalitarian movement. In both Hungary and Poland, we can see that there are definitely signs of political anti-Semitism. It's not like in neither of the states that the government itself is officially anti-Semitic, but we can see a lot of anti-Semitic intellectuals around the government, and there are some hints to the international capital, the background powers, as they say, or even George Soros can serve himself as sometimes a good code word for the Jewish. But I would not say that these governments are themselves are racists or, sure, or fascists. I think the term illiberal describes well the interesting nature of them, which is like they refer in a lot of cases to populist democratic arguments, the will of the people, mm-hmm, and in some elements the democracy is still functioning in these countries, especially in Poland, but even in Hungary. In other cases, we can see a systemic attempt to weaken the democratic institutions. So we can see here a clash between the populist and the elitist definitions of the democracy. Populists are always just referring to the will of the people. Right. Elitistic definitions of the democracy are just about the institution. Institutions these people used to, and the liberals usually used to, ignore the institutions and the human rights. They just focus on the will of the people. But we cannot say that they are totally anti-democratic in every aspect, and we cannot say that they want to, sure, establish a totalitarian fascist state, sure, but they definitely want themselves in power for a very long time, and the tool for do it is to weaken the institution that can curb them their power.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Peter Krecker. And again, of course, it's worth the historical fact is that World War II began with the Nazi and Soviet invasion of Poland. So I thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Krecker, who's a visiting Fulbright Scholar at the Center for Global and International Studies at Indiana University and the director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, Hungary. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.